ladies and gentlemen, my subject is the riddle of Shakespeare. There are two riddles, the sham riddle and the real riddle. I begin by the first because the sham riddle may help us to find our way into the heart of the matter, into the real riddle. I suppose the sham riddle sprang from an awareness of the real riddle. Well, when I speak of the sham riddle, I am speaking, of course, of that wild theory of Mistelia Bacon concerning the authorship of Shakespeare. She thought that Shakespeare was a mere archipelago name for Francis Bacon, Lord Verulam, and she gave her reasons. That happened way back, I think, in 1850 or so, and the volume was the bulky one, with a foreword by Nathaniel Hawthorne, who never read the book, and he said so. There is another theory, perhaps a more plausible one, who, of course, I don't believe in it, by Luther Hoffman, who found another possible candidate, the great poet Christopher Marlowe. Now we will go into the first theory. To this theory has installed in my country by one of the finest scholars we have had, the Frenchman Paul Groussac. He gave two lectures on the subject. And then he fell to thinking how that preposterous, I should say, theory came to be. And he found a reason, and I shall quote it, for I think it is another reason, because it is deeper down than that. It was said that Shakespeare had been made by critics quite to seem sensitive to literature, had been made into a kind of encyclopedia. Those men had thought that Shakespeare knew all the arts, all the sciences of vocabulary might be found in his works. And so he had created a quite unreal Shakespeare, a man full of art, full of sciences, and then, of course, that not hardly tally with the small Latin and less Greek that Ben Jonson told us about, and about the fact, this is more or less well known, I suppose, that Shakespeare was not a reader. Shakespeare did not read. He did not need much reading for his purposes. We know that he had read Chaucer, he had read Spencer, he had read his contemporaries, and we also know about Holinshed, about Plutarch, and about our friend Michel de Montaigne. We know that he read those books, and also out of the way papers that may have come into his hand. And so, Mr. Bacon proposed the theory that Shakespeare was a man of straw, that he was a mere pen name for Francis Bacon, and she gave the reasons, you know, that to be writing for a stage was, in a sense, beneath the dignity of a man like Francis Bacon, and that he might have used William Shakespeare. Well, I think that all that can be explained away, or can be refuted, in quite brief it's a span of time. I will take but a single instance, not derogatory to Bacon. The instance is this. We know that Bacon, in his advancement of learning, thought of errors as being committed by men because the mind of man is not a plain mirror. The mind of man is rather a curved mirror. And so things are not seen as they are, but there are flaws in the image. And then he developed a kind of strange mythology. He called those mistakes, as you know, idols. And then he defined them thus. First we have the idols of the tribe. Those are common to all mankind. For example, we tend to think of things as being far more regular than they are, as being more orderly. Well, the world is perhaps neither regular nor symmetrical. Well, here we have the first idols, those idols, of course, that are lurking all the time. We have the first idols, the idols of the tribe. Then we have, those are common to all men. Then we have the idols of the den. And those are a far stranger species, since every man has his own den, and therein his own secret idols of likes and dislikes, of pet aversions and pet aversions or hatreds. Then we have also the idols of the marketplace, idola fori. The second ones are idola specus, of course. Idola fori are those who fall into too or too credulous belief in language. After all, Bacon said, words on your counters. But people think that they stand for real things. Then we may fall into errors through words. This seems to be happening most of the time. We have a very strange kind of idols, the idola theatri, or idols of the stage. For, said Bacon, every philosophical system creates a stage with the two puppets. And then, when we think, following a certain system, we're not thinking of reality, but of things within the system. And so we have the idola theatri. Now, anybody who's read Shakespeare knows that that kind of mythology or that kind of metaphor is something, let us say, that would hardly belong to Shakespeare. It's not the kind of thought Shakespeare could have had. He's not interested in classifying mistakes. Well, let us take another example. Bacon, and this I think is more to the point, Bacon lived as we all tend to do in history. He thought of the ancients as being children. He thought that we are the ancients. And he thought of being on the threshold of a new age. For he was a father of experimental science. And then he thought much of science, of the advancement of learning, of science. And he wrote perhaps the first, one of the finest pieces of science fiction ever written, The New Atlantis. He also thought that Latin would be the universal language and that English would have its day. He said, modern languages may be playing a trick on us. We are changing all the time. Our Latin, marvelous language as Browning had it, is everlasting. Well, I don't suppose I have to go into anything more, not to convince you that no two more different men ever existed than Francis Bacon and William Shakespeare. It's impossible to think of one as being the other. Well, now we go into the other candidates, which of course is at first sight less unlikely than Bacon, since he was a poet, a great poet, and he wrote lines perhaps as fine as any to be found in Shakespeare, except that I do not think we can speak of a line being finer than another. For when poetry is given to a man, poetry is given to him entirely, so that if a man achieves poetry, that poetry is as fine as any poetry to be found elsewhere. I suppose that at some stage or another, at some moment or another, at some moment when we've been favored by the stars, we have been poets. Perhaps in most cases, poets are poets during a single line or so, while in the case of Shakespeare, the miracle seems to be happening all the time. Now let's consider Christopher Marlowe. I suppose one that fine, that metaphor that can never be tried, may be used. The metaphor of the image of, was this the face that launched a thousand ships and burnt the topless towers of Ilium? And also that Marlowe, in a sense, created the ten-syllable verse. First and last, this was one of the first men to make it into a living thing. Well, we think of those lines within the Renaissance world of Shakespeare, was this the face, not the woman, that launched a thousand ships and in the topless towers of Ilion? Those things cannot be better. Or when he spoke, for example, of Christ's blood streaming in the firmament for the sunset. Those are fine lines also. Well, you can find them all over Marlowe. Remember what Ben Jonson said of Marlowe's mighty line. You're thinking of those verses, of course. But now we go for the way to continue the argument. Well, we know that Ben Jonson, we know that Christopher Marlowe created only a single character. In his chief plays, we find a gigantic figure, Tamerlane, Faustus, the Duke of Malta, and the others are lesser figures. They hardly stand out. They're mere adjectives. They're mere foils to the chief giant, Tamerlane or Faustus. And, of course, at least I can't think of Christopher Marlowe as being able to create the teeming multitudes of Shakespeare. This was quite beyond his scope. Now, I suppose we should think in a way, it's impossible to think that Bacon or Christopher Marlowe or any other candidate is Shakespeare. But perhaps something interesting might be found in the fact that people needed them. That people like to think of somebody else as being the writer of Shakespeare. Mark Twain wrote a very entertaining and a very mistaken book called Who Wrote Shakespeare? He read William Bacon's book. He thought that Bacon might have written the works of Shakespeare. He called Shakespeare the Stratford impostor. Well, those things are no account. But I come to the chief point. And the point is this. Why did people prefer to think that Shakespeare was somebody else's pen name? Why did that strange theory with different candidates come to be favored? This, I think, is the chief point. For example, nobody that I know ever thought of ascribing the works of Dante or Milton to anybody else. This has happened only to Shakespeare. And the reason, I think, may lead us to the real riddle of Shakespeare. I have not solved it, of course. I wonder if riddles should be solved. I suppose there is a beauty in the quest that the fact that a riddle has a beauty of its own, far beyond our solutions. Especially in this case, where I think the solution is impossible. I merely want to point out the riddle. I already said that Francis Bacon was, let's say, historically minded. He knew that he saw the threshold of a new age. He knew that we were the ancients, and that the ancients were mere children. He thought of science as opening unto us the kingdom of man, the regnum hominis, and so on. Now this, in a sense, brings Francis Bacon closer to us, because we are historically minded. I try not to be. For example, when I read in Schopenhauer that historical events are like the shapes of clouds, we look at clouds, and then we may think of them as being mountains, or lions, or dragons, or rivers, or bays. But he said that historical facts were as irrelevant and as passing as other things. But we tend to think in historical terms. For example, we take past time, then we carve it into centuries. We think of one century as being different to another. And Bacon felt that way, and so do most of us. We may try to think in terms of eternity and not of time, but we cannot do that. It is very hard to us. Well, in the case of Shakespeare, as Gustav Spiller pointed out in The Mind of Man, one of the finest stories of Shakespeare ever written, Shakespeare did not think of history in that way. He made all his characters into Elizabethans. He never thought of the differences, and was sure was not concerned about them. I suppose he was right. I suppose man everlasting, as Chesterton has it, is essentially the same. But generally, we try not to think in that way. Well, Shakespeare did. Shakespeare had read Plutarch, he read Holinshed, he knew things had happened in such a date or another, but he thought of all those men as being his contemporaries. And so, in a sense, they were. Since I think that Shakespeare, in some strange way, was a timeless man. Well, for example, if you take a Danish legend, then told by Saxo Grammaticus in his Gesta Danorum, then he took it, but he never worried about the fact that things were happening in Denmark. For example, we have the two soldiers, Francisco and Bernardo, with, here's the Spanish names, then Laertes and Ophelia, Greek names, then Yorick, perhaps in a lot of Scandinavian, then we have Wildenstern and Rosencrantz, they may be Danish, and Hamlet, of course, is the unworthy of Saxo Grammaticus. But really Shakespeare did not care about that. He was not trying to convey to us a dream of something that had happened in Denmark at such and such a historical period. He was doing something far better than that. He thought, I suppose, not in terms of fable, but in terms of Hamlet. And I suppose that when we read Hamlet, we may not believe in the story, we may not believe in the plot, but we certainly believe in Hamlet. Hamlet is as real to us as our friends, Don Quixote. Hamlet is real to us, though the adventures maybe are real. Then also, let us take the case of language. The case of language, I remember that George Moore wrote that Kipling used whole English language, and Shakespeare had. There is a difference. Kipling uses, I suppose, the whole English language, if any writer has ever used it. He used it, let's say, different times for different purposes. Well, in the case of Shakespeare, we get that same strange impression of eternity. We have words, different atmospheres, different connotations, I should say, being used all the time, side by side. That is to say, he took the whole language and he used it for his purposes. For one many writers who favored the Saxon side of English, for example, William Morris, who wrote, for example, the translation of the Odyssey, "Tell me news of the Shifty, the man who wandered afar after the holy bird that tried down yet wasted the war." Both verses would make for a theory. Then we have a very fine translation by Pope. Then the translation when we read, "The man for wisdom's various arts renowned, long exercised in woes, O muse, resound." There you have the fine Latin words. In the case of Shakespeare, it was otherwise. He used both Saxon and both Latin words side by side. I suppose the easiest example would be that one in Hamlet, where he speaks of the seas, using Latin words, and then afterwards he says, "Making the green one red," using short, sharp Saxon words. There's another distinction to be made, and this I think is the reason why Shakespeare, when he's reading, seems to be slipping away from us. How we can hardly cope with Shakespeare. We feel his strength. We feel his strange beauty. But we're unable to follow his way of thinking. Yet Dante, I suppose, quite a finer poet, the greater poet of Shakespeare, but though we're not allowed to be Dante, we understand why he wrote everything. We understand his way of thinking. In the case of Shakespeare, this does not happen. Shakespeare seems not approaches. He seems to be slipping away from us. One of the reasons, I suppose, of the essential riddle of Shakespeare is that we tend to think of arts in terms of classicism or revolution. Whereas the human world had it, we tend to think of art in terms of order and adventure, l'ordre et l'aventure. We think, for example, let us say, of we think, for example, of Pope as being a classicist, of Joyce as being a revolutionary, and so on. But Shakespeare is beyond those definitions. Hugo, one of the finest of Shakespearean critics, he was a poet, and also both, I suppose a critic should be a poet, used Shakespeare for his own purposes. But Shakespeare, of course, is far beyond the 1830 discussion on surrealism, on romanticism and classicism. Hugo used it for that purpose. Now, in the case of Shakespeare, I would say that there is no such distinction. If we think of him as a classicist, then, of course, we find that he's full of romantic traits long before romantic movement. If we think of him as a romantic, we have to think that he accepted many things. Well, you should say that Shakespeare took a plot. And then he had his dream with that plot. He was dreaming it over, and then he used it. But he had what Victor Hugo called this absence de l'infini. What you say, Shakespeare is unaccountable, and that may be one of the reasons for his charm, for his witchcraft. The fact, as I said, that he's living away from us, that we don't know where to have him. And strange things, as we all know, happen in his plays. For example, in one of his plays, we have the Milius Gloriosus, the braggart, the cowardly soldier, who is detected, who is exposed, he is obedient to captain, but he is exposed before the other men, he has to fall back on being a soldier. All this time has been a stock figure. The stock figure, let us say, of Latin tragedy, the Milius Gloriosus. And then suddenly, Shakespeare sees him, and he sees him, let us say, reborn. And then we have this wonderful line. We have Captain, I'll be no more. And then he goes on to say, simply the thing I am shall make me live. The thing I am. The man has been exposed. The man has been ridiculed. He knows that everybody knows that he's a coward, a craven. And yet, simply the thing I am shall make me live. That is to say, he feels something essential within himself. He feels an essential Godhead within himself. And when this secondary character in one of Shakespeare's plays says those things, simply the thing I am shall make me live, then we roll back to the voice of God in the burning bush. We roll back to God saying to Moses from the bush, I am that I am. Or when we think of Swift wandering over his house, big house in Dublin, mad and still clinging to that one fact. He was who he was, and muttering to himself and being overheard by others, saying, I am that I am, I am that I am. this miracle happens in the line of Shakespeare, and then it's forgotten by him. It isn't if Shakespeare were unconscious of what we're doing. Or if Shakespeare were doing many things at the same time, and doing many things that may not be seen by us. But those things are happening. So that we have the strangest of characters in literature, the character of Shakespeare. Perhaps a word might be found. Of course, no word can be the word. Since after all, words are, as Bacon pointed, words are mere coins. One should take them into account. And suppose this word might help us not into understanding Shakespeare, since we won't hardly understand Shakespeare. Shakespeare is beyond us. Shakespeare looms over us. Shakespeare is greater, so even than Dante, because somehow we can follow Dante's way of thinking. We will not be able to do what he has done. No man is able to do that. But still, we know the way he was thinking. In the case of Shakespeare, we don't. And suppose that word will be... acceptance. The fact is this. And suppose that Shakespeare received all things. Think of the vast hospitality of his mind. Of course, I suppose Coleridge and Hazlitt meant the same thing when they talked about Shakespeare being a substance that could take any shape it wanted to. I wrote a piece once based on Hazlitt and Coleridge called Everything and Nothing. And therein, I compared Shakespeare working out his world to God creating the world, neither of them being knowing who they were, or having to create things. Now Shakespeare accepted all the rites, all the ceremonies, we might say, all the trifles of contemporary drama. He accepted all the conventions, so that he was no revolutionary. He was beyond that. He accepted, for example, the wholesale slaughter at the end of the tragedies. He accepted the monologues, he accepted the asides, he took plots to make him foreign to his character. Bernard Shaw said we should try to think of the characters of Shakespeare themselves beyond the plots, but Shakespeare accepted them. He knew that he would have his will with them. And then he would illuminate them, and then suddenly, in a flash, he would make to see the character beyond the stock convention of the plot. He accepted the things. At the same time, he took language. I said a moment ago that he used both the Saxon and the Latin elements of the English language, but he used far more than that. He was coining new words. He went on for the strangest of metaphors, metaphors that cannot be explained. In the case of Hugo, for example, a very fine poet, in the case of Hugo, all his metaphors can be explained. They are logical. For example, when Hugo said of the nightmare, le cheval noir de la nuit, the black horse of night, we accept it because in order to think of the word nightmare in English, and then black seems to be the right word, we can explain it. In the case of Shakespeare, I don't suppose we can. Those things have to be accepted. It has been said that Shakespeare can be translated into any other language. I should say it can be translated into English either. Since he wrote what Stevenson called what amazing dialect the Shakespeare is. For example, Hoban Mugiru revisits clad in complete steel, revisits just the glimpses of the moon. Hoban Mugiru, the glimpses of the moon. I don't think we can be translated. Perhaps no words can be translated. Certainly, Shakespeare cannot be translated. The glimpse of the moon means exactly the glimpse of the moon. But you say it has a value of its own. It is a world of its own. So he used language with a vast freedom. He could mix his metaphors. He would talk of taking arms against the Sea of Troubles. That did not worry him. He knew that he could do it. He could do anything he wanted. He accepted all the conventions and he made the boldest of literary experiments. Those things he did at one stroke, he was somehow aware of them. He was so aware of them that when he left London, he went to his provincial town, he went in for being a citizen of Stockport, he went in and read, let's say, for memorandum, he went in for he said no word about his plays. And this, in Rousseau, is something more striking than things a poet has written, despising their own word, their own work. For Shakespeare would have despised his own work. Well, he had bought his book, he had done his book as Prospero, and he thought no more about it. He was a master of words, never trying to find the words in order to despise or to forget his own work. What if he forgot what about it? I suppose we can never find our way into his mind. And that is, I suppose, the witchcraft, the magic nature of Shakespeare. We may be amazed and jump. Milton, but somehow we understand them. We can follow the way their minds worked. But in the case of Shakespeare, we cannot. He is slipping away from us all the time. He goes from one thing to another. He uses English language in the same sentence. He uses words with different connotations. To sleep, what chance to dream is there to rub? Well, very few words with different connotations to them, and they come right, as they should. Well, for example, was it the proud full sail of his great birth, bound for the prize of all too precious youth? Well, those magnificent lines, for we're finding them all the time. At the same time, we know that we're losing many things. For of course, Shakespeare is too vast for us. Perhaps the only conclusion left is this, that the fact that Shakespeare is unattainable, that Shakespeare gives us beauty but cannot be grasped by us, that Shakespeare is not to be explained or explained away, this makes for his unique position in literature. He seems to be there all the time. We know that within 100 years, or within any number of years again, Shakespeare will be as mysterious as he is today. We know that we cannot cope with him. I don't try to explain him. He has been with me throughout my life. And I know that my life is different without Shakespeare. And I know that wrote about Shakespeare, the fact that Shakespeare was all men. He was thinking in terms of pantheism. He thought of Shakespeare as a Proteus, and perhaps that is the right approach. Shakespeare became all his multitudes of men, and he also created a new language made of English words, but a new language by itself. And he created many characters, and those characters will of course survive. Since they do not belong to the fables, they do not belong to certain period in history. They seem to be all the time there. And suppose our common conclusion is this. We worship Shakespeare, and we know as little about Shakespeare as we know about God. Thank you.